Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Want to talk about a new movie? Check. Want to talk about an older movie similar or related to that new movie?
Check.
That's what you can expect from Quality Check Podcast.
It's a new podcast on the Studio DNA Network hosted by yours truly, Drew Douglas and
Daniel Posey. Every other Tuesday, we'll talk about a new movie and an old movie to see how the film's quality holds up.
What Else with Corey Mann on the Studio DNA Podcast Network.
Do we call Steve Ford the general manager of Centricity Music? Is that the actual title?
Yeah, I am general manager of Centricity Music, yes.
How long has that been now?
About 4, maybe 5 years. Oh. I was here for about 10 years before that, where Mays and I were sort of... I'm employee number 2 at Centricity. Mays is number 1. He dragged me over. He converted me.
Steve, does your origin start in Los Angeles? Is that where you were born?
Born and raised, my friend. High school, college, first jobs, you know, church, everything was right there in the heart of the San Fernando Valley.
Are mom and dad from Los Angeles, or did they come from somewhere and start their story there?
Honestly, my dad, I don't have a whole lot of relationship with. He left when I was 5 and honestly never saw him again. So when you say my dad, I think of my stepdad. And my stepdad came from Pennsylvania. I think my real dad came from Oregon, if I remember right. And my mom came from Illinois. And they met somewhere in L.A. Got married when she was 18.
You and I have that in common. My mom was a young mom, too. What did mom do in Los Angeles?
My mom was, at that point, she was called a secretary. Now it would be an executive assistant. She took shorthand. She had notes and, you know, pages of those little notebooks with shorthand on it that I had no idea what any of it meant. And then she could type like a banshee. She was so good at it. And she quit working right around when I was about 15. But she, yes, I never talked to her about all of the harassment and everything that she had to have taken by that point, you know, through the 60s, you know, because my mom was a single mom in 1964 or 5. I mean, I can't imagine what was happening at that point.
When I wrote down the word Los Angeles to start the conversation, in my head, Steve, I thought about all the different versions myself or anybody would assume with that word, you know, Hollywood, the actor's town, musicians, production. What is Los Angeles to you growing up? What is your version of that town to you?
Oh, man. It was Van Nuys Boulevard and In-N-Out Burger and church in San Fernando Valley. You know, I was enjoying music and loving music. And my first concert my mom took me to when I was probably 12 years old, because she worked with a guy in Andre Crouch and the Disciples. That was my first concert. The Polo Ted Lasso, you know, my first concert was Andre Crouch.
What would be your first considered mainstream concert?
Oh, that would have been might have been my first mainstream concert. Good question. Probably at a small club somewhere in L.A. When I was 17, I ended up going to the Troubadour and the Whiskey A Go-Go and the Roxy, trying to see all these wannabe bands and bad. So, you know, I saw a bunch of people in those halls. I saw, U2 for the first time at the in Reseda, at the Country Club in Reseda is what it was called, you know, and 1,000 people, and it was amazing. I don't know. No one's ever asked me that question.
Can you find the origin of when you knew, like, I love what's either coming out of that speaker or playing on the record player? Do you remember that moment of, ooh, I like this?
We had, my brothers bought one of those plastic turntables when I was probably 9, you know, and my mom had terrible taste in music, but I listened to every one of her Elvis Presley's gospel record. And I would listen to it because I would escape. You know, I was trying to escape. I escaped in books and I escaped into music. And then when we got a TV when I was 10, we escaped into TV. You know, my mom would take us out to drive-in movie theaters every Friday night because I have 2 older brothers, and it was just her. And she'd pay like nothing to get in for a car rate. And we'd watch all these. One of my greatest memories is hiding behind the front seat when the music for Planet of the Apes was just freaking me out, you know? So I hid behind the front seat going, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear this. I was probably like 7. So, you know, those are the memories. There's music all over. But then I turned 14 years old. You know, my brothers had all the Beatles and all that stuff. And when I was 14 years old, I read an article by a guy named Sir George Martin. He produced the Beatles, and he talked about producing records and talked about Jeff Emmerich, the engineer. And I was like, you could do that for a living? And my life changed. You know, my mom tried to talk me out of it. Like, that's a good hobby, but, you know, you need a real job. So I still went to college. But, man, the minute I walked out of high school, I walked into recording studios. Oh, yeah. I remember reading that and going, oh, my gosh, that's a job. And I wasn't good enough for in front of the microphone, dude. So I wanted to be surrounded by music my whole life. So I got behind the microphone instead.
So I feel like that actually happened. Did you go, I want to learn how to do this? And you walked into a studio? Like, tell me that story.
I want to learn how to do this. So I started like every 5 on the Enneagram, started trying to read everything I could about producers and engineers. And there was nothing, man. There was nothing in those days in the library because there was no Google. And then I started looking up recording studios in North Hollywood and Van Nuys and all around the San Fernando Valley. And I started knocking on doors, man. I went to a recording school for a little while that summer to learn how to align tape machines and cut tape and all of that. It was a complete waste of time. And I knocked on a door and they said, come on in. Do you know how to make coffee? And I lied and said, yep. And I was making really horrible coffee for, you know, 3 months at that studio. And then I went and worked at another studio. That was Conway. And then I worked at another studio for Wizard Recording Studios, answering the phones at night, vacuuming and making coffee. And that's where you start. And then one day, the second engineer who you help do whatever you can said, hey, I can't be there. Can you set up this session? And that's how I got my first session of aligning tape machines and setting up microphones. And then pretty soon I was working during the day doing that stuff. And yeah, it was, you do what everybody does. You start at the bottom and you outwork everybody. You know, I loved it, man.
I've tried multiple times asking you to give me a glimpse at who you worked with. And you always keep me at bay a little bit, but I've done just a slight bit of homework, and our running joke between each other is whenever I see that Wang Chung record at a record show, I take a picture of it. Give me some of the names that you remember, Steve, sure, working with in and out of the studios, who you'd see coming and going, and who you actually got to put your hands on production wise.
Just in the studio. I was staff engineer at Mama Joe's recording studio for about 6 years. And so 6 out of those years. A couple years before that, a lot of other studios, but worked everything from Stanley Clark to Oingo Boingo, you know. At Mama Joe's, we were a mix room, and so we would spend a week and a half mixing. So I worked with everyone from Pat Benatar, Maurice White, to, of course, Wang Chung, the one you like the most quintessential, you know, 90s song ever recorded, or 80s song. From that to, like, Neil Diamond and Burt Bacharach and Melissa Manchester and Philip Bailey and I did a lot of work with a guy named Jack Joseph Quaig, who was my mentor. We did Roger Hodgson, who was the lead singer of Supertramp. You know, I was really nervous with that. Did some work with Carrie Livgren, a guitar player for Kansas. Commercials for Rosarita Beans. You know, you do whatever was hired that day. One of my favorite stories is when we were mixing a record from John Michael Talbot. You know, quiet, peaceful. And there was a band called Oingo Boingo, which was huge on the West Coast. And they had a side band called Malibu 16, Malibu 60, something like that. And some of the guys came in and they met John Michael in the hallway, you know? And it was like, the only thing I remember them saying was, do you wear something underneath that? And he pulled it up and showed his shorts, you know? It was weird, you know? It was a great life. Well, it wasn't a great life. It was a lot of fun.
For those who don't know, John Michael Talbot, give me the 30-second version of who he was.
He was in an acoustic rock band for a while with his brother Terry, and then became a Catholic monk. He wore robes, the brown robe, and his music is absolutely beautiful and quiet and meditative and everything that Oingo Boingo wasn't. So
where does faith intersect your life where you quote unquote got it?
Oh gosh. I was born in the third row of a Lutheran church. I could swear, you know, my mom would drag us. She sang in the choir and man, the three of us would be sitting there silently. Cause if my mom saw us not, all she would do is like squint. And you knew you were in trouble. You know that. You know that look you get across the room from your mom. It's like, uh-oh. And then you just start, like, getting really nervous. So I was born in church, really. We bounced around and ended up in a non-denominational church out in L.A. And Jesus was always there, you know, always a part of that journey. But I was always the guy, like, it was a really conservative church in L.A. And I had, at that point, really long hair. And I was the only guy in this, like, thousands of members church with long hair. They'd be like, you know, Steve Ford, the guy with the hair. And they go, oh, yeah, that guy. I truly believe that you discover Jesus and you truly discover your need for a savior when you're broken. I was broken in that my marriage. And that's where I truly believe. And dude, I was saying all the right things. I knew all the right Bible verses. And I knew all that stuff. But I think it was a much more logical faith. And then as my marriage fell apart and, you know, all of that, I think it Jesus finally was going like, are you finally going to let me in? Are you finally going to let me, not in as much as, are you finally going to give me control? Because, man, I'm a control freak, dude. I want to take care of it myself. I overthink everything. All of that. And for me to finally go, well, I mucked this up here. Let me give this to you. What I really want to do is go fix it. You know, and Jesus goes, walk with me. I truly believe we need our scars in order to truly understand why we need a savior. So it was in those scars that I found him.
Was it hard for you to leave Los Angeles or was it necessary? Was it time?
It was time. You know, what's really funny is I started, my daughter was born. My oldest daughter was born and I was like, okay, God, I don't know what to do here because 18 hour days does not make a good dad. And I was praying, my wife and I were praying, going, oh Lord, you know, find me the same clients or find me another way. And honestly, 2 days later, I talked to Peter York in the studio. I was mixing something for him and I was talking to him of like, how do you do this? How do you have a family? And he was a very wise man in my life. And 2 days after Kelly and I prayed about this, he calls me up and goes, dude, have you ever thought of getting into A&R? And that's how I walked into my first record label and as what A&R coordinator or whatever that was with Peter York. He was in Nashville and I was in LA in the Chatsworth office. And in 1991 or 90, they decided to move the company. And in January 91, I was a Nashvilleian. I flew two young daughters and my then wife out here. And, you know, I was in the A&R department at Sparrow trying to figure out what all this meant. And Peter York was a great boss for me. You know, and above that, I got to experience the passion of Billy Ray Hearn and the wisdom of Bill Hearn, who is probably the most brilliant marketing guy I've worked with. And yeah, it was a great school. You know, Peter was a great A&R guy, and the people at the top there were world class. And I got to go to school with them for 6 years or 7 years and really learn from them.
We'll be back.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Give me some names who you worked with at Sparrow. You A&R'd for who during that time?
Peter was really the head A&R guy. I was sort of the assistant to him. Yeah, I brought in Bob Carlisle. I did a lot of quality control and mastering and all of that stuff. And I told Steven this, I started at Sparrow right before Real Life Conversations from Steven Kurzgesagt came out. So Stephen Curtis Chapman and BB and CC Winans and Jeff Moore in the distance, and Steve Green was still there, and I was the A&R guy trying to set up their archives and work all of that. Yeah, it was, you know, it's weird to go, who'd you sign and work with? Because it's like, yes, sort of like everybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's when they signed Out of the Gray, and that's when they signed Charlie Peacock and Jimmy Abeg, and you know, some of the people I still know. You know, we had a guy named Steve Wiggins. They ended up dropping him. He went over to Forefront and had a little song called Two Sets of Joneses that did okay for him. Yeah, you know, just all of that. If like God calls some people for long term, God calls some people for a shorter journey. You know, that just the music industry is a part of their journey as they lead, go some sort of like engineering was for me. It wasn't my lifelong journey. It was just a part of my journey.
You go from Los Angeles to setting up microphones and doing production stuff. And it sounds like you might have gotten away from that in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Like, was that an adjustment for you? Do you feel like you had to leave that behind to move forward? Or did you still have enough of your toe in that pool to satisfy that need?
I felt like I had to move away from that. And for a while, I was mad at God. I was mad going, okay, why was I in this dark room in this in recording studios for, you know, 9.5, 10 years? Then I realized every day of my job since then, the 30-something years I've been on the dark side, I've used information that I learned in recording studios. You know, whether it be the first few years, I was overseeing all the mastering of the records. So I still got to go into mastering facilities and work with them, those people, especially on the you know, because recording record labels make a ton of different compilations. So I was doing all of that stuff and, you know, mastering all of that and working with different mastering engineers. And I helped put together, you know, Peter had me assist him on the Keith Green tribute album that was released many, many, many years ago. It's been 30-something years, 33 years in the dark. I call it the dark side, the corporate side. And I miss recording studios. I miss the time there. I miss the creativity of that. I miss the honestly, the camaraderie, because you close the door to a recording studio and there seems to be walls drop for artists. It's a safe place. The things that go on in there, in those rooms, usually aren't talked about very much, you know, because it's because you, they want a safe place. They, because you're working on lyrics, they're working on songs. I remember Bill Maxwell came in with boxes of Keith Green demos after Keith's plane crashed. And he booked over a week of time to start working on the records after Keith died. And Melody and her daughter were sitting in the back of the room just weeping as they were listening to Keith Green demos of which ones would go on those records. And, you know, just some of the stuff you see. And you see totally the opposite side, you know, where you're working on a rock record and you go, you left a little line on the bathroom counter. What do you want to do with that? You know? So you see it all. I saw someone anoint a tape machine with oil once. And then I saw somebody bring in have his dealer drop off dime bags of cocaine. So it's just all those two different extremes, you know, because we were a studio that did a lot of Christian music. I worked a lot with Brown Bannister and Jack Joseph Quagg and Jonathan David Brown and those early producers of Christian music that taught me a lot about songs and, you know, how to make songs better.
We're going to jump forward real, real far because there's a lot that happens between Sparrow and the way I understand it. John Mayes calls you and says, hey, come do this thing with me at Centricity. Is that how that played out?
Never had to call because at that point we were playing racquetball every morning. He and I played racquetball for about 15 years together. And wow. I was at InPop when we started. And then one day he's like, I've got this thing I'm working on. And I'm like, oh, another rich guy starting a record label. Nah, no thanks. I was in a good spot. And he kept saying, you know, talking about it with me. And that's honestly when my marriage fell apart right in that era. And he was like, come join me, man. And it's like, I needed something new and I needed something. And I met with my boss, Karen Seidel, and asked her all the hard questions of like, how long is he in for this? How long? What's the expectations? All of that, because it takes 7 years for a record label to start breaking even, because where it comes from is catalog, not from front end releases. When you have catalog that just makes money without you having to spend money, that's when it starts working a little better. And you have to, it takes years to build that catalog. And so when she gave me all the right answers and I was like, okay, let's go. I think John's jaw dropped when I said yes, you know, because, you know, I had a dream job. I was over a record label that was well-financed and with people I love working with that I pursued and signed. And it was like, no, it's time for me to go. That was the closest I've had to God saying, this is where you need to be.
Give me a great Centricity story when you saw it and you went, okay, this is working. Either this is going to work or this is working. I can see that this, I'm in the right place.
Wow, that's a good question. Okay, this is probably not the first time, but I remember sitting and playing Lauren's first record for people.
We're talking about Lauren Daigle.
Lauren Daigle. Yeah, this was Lauren's first record, How Can It Be? And we had five songs for her. And I went around and played it for radio people. I think you were one of them. And I played two songs for people. And dude, as a sidebar, I was always the nerd in high school making cassette tapes for my friends.
Me too.
I was the guy going, oh man, I know who you are. And I just made you this 90-minute cassette tape of all these great songs I think you're going to love. I loved that. That's what I get to do for a living. So sitting down and playing you and other radio guys, and at that point, retail guys, the music of Lauren. And I remember so many people going, wow, when we played him, it was How Can It Be and Trust in You. Those were the two songs we played. And just going, I love this. It energized me. It brought me quite a bit of joy of sitting there in your office or in a car. I think with you, it was in my car.
Yeah.
Because most radio guys have terrible sound systems. It's true. You know it.
I'd like a second chance. I've upgraded since then.
and in the car playing it for people and just seeing the goosebumps and seeing the responses. And it's like, I love that. It's the same feeling I had when somebody listened to a cassette in high school and said, man, great songs. Same feeling. I remember doing that with Salvador. I remember doing it with when I was at Myrrh. You know, I remember doing it with just introducing new artists is one of my favorite things to do.
I remember hearing Salvador for the first time. Oh, so good. Horns.
So good. Why didn't that work? Man, Nick was a star.
So hang on a second. I was not in this industry at that time, but you said, why didn't that work? From my perspective, it did. But are you talking on a sales and stickiness perspective?
Stickiness of touring. It was one of the best touring bands. I don't know if you ever saw him live.
I did.
Good.
I saw him do a TV show here in this building, and I was blown away.
The bass player, I mean, we signed him at Myrrh when he was 18 years old, and you hated him because he was so talented and so good. And Nick, when he would smile on that stage, when you see people who are born to be in the place that they're supposed to be, the place they are, you're born to be behind a microphone. You see it. He was born to be on that stage leading people. And the sales never really happened the way I thought they were going to, because, man, that was one of my favorite bands to work with. One of the underrated, you know, if you want a band that's like Santana, half jam band, half worship, it's just so. Go back and listen to that. That's so good.
One of Centricity's new artists that I'm excited about is Patrick Mayberry. When I heard his new song, I personally went, there it is. It's got the thing. In 2021, Steve, what are you listening for that you would be able to go, there it is?
It has to have a great melody, great lyrics, and have deep meaning. I look for the Me Too moment where there's a universal emotion that I go, oh, I feel the same thing. A great song tells the story of my life. I remember talking to my stepdaughter when she was much younger and Taylor Swift was coming out. And I said, why do you love Taylor Swift? And she was like, oh, she tells the story of my life. She sings my life. Isn't that what Olivia Rodrigo is doing? Isn't that what even Christian music is, you know, doing and Lauren Daigle doing? When you hear You Say, you go, I need to hear that. You know, does this song make me feel like I need to hear over and over and over again, whether it be singing along? It makes you, it moves people, moves them to think, moves them to dance, moves them to sing, and moves them to worship. Those are the four ways I think you could, that songs can move people. The thinking part is probably the least commercially successful, you know, because people want to sing, people want to raise their hands, people want to feel something. You know, you've heard a song where you go, me too. Oh, me too. When I first heard Chainbreaker, when Jeff Cruz played that for me, I was like, me too. That was, you know, I just went, yeah. When I heard Reason for Unspoken, those ones where you point to and go, there it is, those come very seldom. In the last few years, it's been like Reason, You Say. Oh my gosh. I tried to convince Lauren in management to record You Say 3 years before she released it, or 2 years before she released it. I had a whole plan laid out, and she was like, no, nah, I want to hold it for the record. Smart choice. She was right. But the minute you heard it, you went, yep, there it is. You've heard those. You've heard those songs. Yep, there it is. When I heard, like I said, there's a few of those where it's like, mm-hmm. They don't happen very often. And it's for me as an overthinker, now is that saying the right thing? What are they going to say that's going to turn us down? Do they really like, what's the part they're going to remember? What's the Me Too moment? Brandon Heath's new song, I Am Not God's Problem, We Are God's Children. Yeah. Yeah. I want to hear that. Over and over and over again. I really need to remember that over and over and over, that I am not God's problem. You know, whether it be Eddie Van Halen with guitar riffs, whatever you do to play along, sing along with that song, that's the hook. Come on, there's a drum fill that's a hook for a song, isn't there? In the Air Tonight, Phil Collins. Da-dung, 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 dung, dung.
Iconic.
Iconic. I was at a show at the Bridgestone Arena, I think it was John Mayer, and they're playing that song as before the set started. And I was just watching the audience, and the air drums that were played in that audience, everybody just went, da-dum, 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 da-dum. you know, you can just see it. You know, you know the hooks. If there's a hook, and man, it's got, in today's world, it's got, you can't have 7 seconds without it.
What Else with Corey Mann on the Studio DNA Podcast Network. Leave some feedback. Write a review. Hit the subscribe button so you never miss a new episode. What Else with Corey Mann on the Studio DNA Podcast Network.
This is great, Steve. I appreciate you, pal.
You're a good man, Corey Mann.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.